Before we get started with today's show, we have an announcement to make. Grant, would you do the honors?
Yeah, I'd love to, Brooke. Thanks to your expert counting, the news is that today is our 100th episode, and we're also nearly 2 years into this podcast already.
What has been the best part of doing this podcast for you, Grant?
Many things, but I think hands down the amazing guests we've had over these 100 shows. We started this whole thing wanting to do something for our communities, but I don't think I could have anticipated the thrill of getting to speak with so many authors that I admire so greatly and across so many different genres. Kiese Lehmann, Elizabeth Gilbert, Veronica Roth, Daniel Jose Older, Jasmine Guillory, Marissa Meyer, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, it's so true. I still get such a thrill when an author I've loved for years and years agrees to be on the show. And sometimes I honestly just feel like jumping up and down when we land someone I'm a big fan of. For instance, I don't think I ever imagined we'd interview Pico Iyer or Jeanette Walls or Jane Smiley, to name a few that were pretty pie in the sky for us.
Definitely. And not to mention Kwame Alexander, Cory Doctorow, or Piper Kerman. If listeners can't tell, we're teasing you to go through our backlist and listen to these amazing authors. And I'm looking forward to our August episodes as well, where we'll cull our favorite shows from the year and revisit some of those highlights.
Yeah, me too. That's always fun. So happy 100th show, Grant. Thank you so much for doing this with me every single week.
Yeah, I think we make a good team. So I'm looking forward to the next 100 episodes.
We do, and I'm looking forward to the next 100, too. Hello, experimentalists, language enthusiasts, deep thinkers, and those who march to the beat of your own drum. Today's interview is another installment from Women Lit, which moved online this spring, but which very much exists in person, and is an amazing resource for Bay Area writers who would like to become members, especially once we can convene together again. Women Lit is a year-round series focusing on bringing female-identified authors to the Bay Area. With a focus on elevating women's voices, Women Lit has hosted some of the great feminist thinkers and authors of our time, including Gloria Steinem, Terry Tempest Williams, Rachel Cusk, and Eve Ensler. And now we're bringing you Emer McBride, author of the novels The Lesser Bohemians, winner of the James Tate Black Memorial Prize, and A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, winner of the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction and others. Her newest novel is called Strange Hotel. Strange Hotel is, in fact, a strange book. It's enigmatic, lacking in context, a book about thinking, and more than that, a woman thinking and thinking about herself. For that reason, it's been called solipsistic, and Emer agrees that it is, and she balks at the idea that it shouldn't be. Have we decided, she asks, that we're done with novels that are about thinking? The entire history of novel writing has been about thinking about what it means to be a person, and yet she asserts, suddenly this is unacceptable. I think she has a right to be frustrated and disturbed, and it's also a beautiful thing that she's made it her life's work to be a voice that insists, unapologetically, that her work has a very important place in the literary canon. So you're in for a treat because Emer brings a sophistication to the experience of experimenting with novels, with prose, with language, with words. She's been compared to her fellow Irish literary giants, James Joyce and Samuel Beckett. And in this interview, she'll share some of her more modern inspirations, too. Today's interview is a short selection from a longer interview with Emer, so if you'd like to watch it in its entirety, please find it on the official Bay Area Book Festival video channel on YouTube. Enjoy the interview. Hi, Emer. So good to see you.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So your work has been compared to James Joyce and Samuel Beckett, two of the most celebrated Irish authors of all times, and you received the inaugural fellowship at the Samuel Beckett Research Center. So from looking at that, what I gathered is that you were tasked to creatively engage with Beckett's writing and ideas during that time. So I wanted to start by asking you how you feel about these comparisons, and if you were expected to create a work that engaged with Beckett's ideas in some sort of creative way.
Well, I mean, the comparison thing first, I suppose, you know, you can't complain too much about being compared to Joyce and Beckett. And but at the same time, it's something of a burden, because people then expect you as a writer to be have the same preoccupations as they did, or the same interests, or being keen to kind of follow in their footsteps. And while both the writers were certainly an influence on me, and Joyce very particularly, when I first set out writing, I don't feel that we are especially interested in the same things beyond an interest in language and form. And so often, I suppose, I think the comparisons are a kind of a shorthand for describing what I'm doing. I'm an Irish writer who's interested mm-hmm. in language, so therefore I kind of belong to that, the club of oddities.
You described Strange Hotel as a surprise, and now I can see that you were writing a story, it sounds like, and suddenly you realized you had a book. So what is it like to realize that something is a book when you thought it wasn't? And when did you know? I mean, was it just about the length, or was it some other indication?
I think I realized that it was going to be more than a story when I got to the end of the first section, Avignon, and realized that that wasn't going to be the end. That there was more, because I was, even though I was kind of winding it down, bringing it to that section to its conclusion, I could feel other ideas about this woman and other places bubbling up, and I wasn't really sure how far that would go. And originally it was four parts, and now it's six parts. Okay. But yeah, so it was a surprise, and but also kind of nice, because it was in a way a little bit like writing what it was like when I wrote A Girl as a Half-Formed Thing, which is to say that it was written completely in private, with no one knowing about it, with no expectation placed on it, I didn't sell it, there was no one breathing down my neck for the manuscript. It was in a way accidentally recreating the kind of the perfect conditions to write a book in, where there's no pressure and there's no expectation. You don't even think you yourself are that's what you're doing for a long time, and you're, you know, you've got the privacy and the time to fail, which of course is the most important thing to be able to do.
Right. That does sound lovely, especially in light of a lot of pressure coming from other places. In Strange Hotel, I noticed that many reviews called it enigmatic. And by definition, that means mysterious, puzzling, or difficult to understand. And I'm guessing that this, from having read it, that that's by design somewhat. We find the protagonist in a series of hotel rooms over this multi-year period, and it does feel that the point is to lose sense of time and place, and to show how we can and do exist differently and singularly when we're removed from the contexts of our lives. So the Guardian review said the book lacked context. Is this lack of context, in fact, one of its organizing principles?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the game of it was really to see how much you could get away with withholding. Mm. How much do we need to know about a character in order to be willing to pursue them through however many short, you know, pages that the book goes along with? I mean, I think I really wanted to just lift her out of time and out of place, and so that it's really a book about the internal life. It's a book that is, you know, as opposed to my first two novels, it's a book that is thinking about feeling rather than filled with feeling. And that was, you know, a very conscious decision to kind of step away, one, from all the kind of the feeling of hysteria there seems to be in the world at the moment, where everyone is busily expressing maximum emotion at all times, outrage, you know, love, admiration, disgust, everything is kind of wrapped up. And I suppose I feel, and I wanted to explore this as well in the book, that that I'm now in middle age, and all this kind of endless hysterical kind of emoting didn't really feel like something I could connect to, and I thought, how interesting to write a character who isn't involved in that, who is really about thought, and who is actively using thought as a way to distance herself from emotion. And emotion leaks through, but she's not interested in sharing all her deep feelings. She's actually actively trying to keep them at bay.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I glean that that's frustrating for some readers, you know, and yeah,
and I don't make it easy.
No, you don't make it easy, and it also seems like, you know, that's kind of something that you're perhaps intentionally doing. You know, you're not bound to conventional rules or prose or anything for that matter, and it can be challenging to read. You acknowledge, and since you seemingly want it to be that way, you know, I'm saw where you were saying, you know, you want literary reads to be challenging and perhaps expect them to be and want the reader to work a bit. So what kind of reading experience do you imagine for your reader when they sit down to read a Emer McBride novel?
Well, I suppose what I want, and maybe this is not so different to what every other writer wants, is for the reader to approach it knowing that they have to really engage with it, that this is not a book that they can skim through for the best bits and get the gist of, that if they don't read it, every word of it, they will miss something. They will really miss something. And that in a book like Strange Hotel particularly, you know, the process is all, it's not about plot, it's not about getting to an end point, it's not about a moment of revelation, it's, you know, everything is about the process of going through, thinking about thinking, examining what it is to be who she is. And I suppose I don't see that there's any harm in that. And I hope that there is enough in the book to keep the reader entertained, because I also think it's a much funnier book than, you know, my first two books, that she is aware that she is driving herself crazy with her incessant nitpicking and her kind of returning to themes and ideas and not getting any further. And the whole point of the book is that she is stuck within herself. She's created a cycle in which she can only think about herself in a particular way and can't get out of it and is frustrated by it, but is also unwilling to step beyond that and to go into a new kind of life.
It's fascinating because it strikes me that some of the criticisms that have been lobbed at the book are the very things that you pretty much effectively wanted to do, you know, because there's some readers accused you of being solipsistic, and it prompted me to look into, like, what does that even mean in literature? And it's basically the desire to distance the world. And one of the primary themes seems to be aloneness, loneliness, escape from the world, escape from the past. And your point in response to that was that it was a kind of a gendered accusation, which I agree with, and that readers call it out in women writers in ways that they wouldn't men writers. Do I have the right take on this? And I was just wondering if you would say a bit more.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I mean, are we seriously in this day and age saying we're done with novels that are about thinking? That's done now, is it? Like, this is the entire history of literary fiction from the inception of the novel have been books thinking about what it means to be a person. And for suddenly that to be unacceptable, I think is actually quite a disturbing trend. And it's become more and more prevalent where a book is not allowed to be about thinking. It's not allowed to offer a challenge or a puzzle for the reader. It's not allowed to try and activate their interests in different ways. It's not allowed to expect a commitment or a concentration of even a short amount of time that you're supposed to be on all the time, entertaining, throwing out the big moments, giving everyone the big feels. And I find that very disturbing. And I think I think solipsism is, no one ever called Beckett solipsistic. You know, right, I think it's something that is particularly gendered because the idea of a woman who's thinking about herself, not thinking about others, is something which is particularly still taboo. And you know, that we must always be demonstrating our willingness to offer and to give rather than to withhold. I think, you know, come on now, grow up. I'm not willing to go down this route, and I know that is the trend, but I'm holding out in hope of better times.
Well, good for you. Yes, and then that, I mean, it does kind of go back to the point that I'm saying. I think there is a lot of sort of accusation and criticism, and it felt like this is what she's trying to do. You know, so it's effective and people have feelings about that, which I think could be a good thing. A good conversation, certainly. I mean, there is a lot of self-reflection on the part of your protagonist. She has memories of the past, lots of alluding to pain and trauma. She analyzes her thoughts. We see her mulling over whether to do things or not. I mean, you're talking about this, so kind of this obsession space that she gets into. And she doesn't dwell, as I think many novels do, on the meanings or motivations behind sex or a one-night stand. And in that way, I thought it felt very feminist. The protagonist is, in fact, quite empowered. So you wrote or said, either way, about her actions, yes, the risk is always there and nothing terrible happens to her in this book, but it could really, really easily. So could you say more about how you wanted your reader to interpret your protagonist? I mean, you certainly began to talk about that, but why not have something bad happen to her?
I think, in the past, I've obviously written a lot about women and sexual trauma and surviving or not surviving it. And I suppose I felt it was time to look at sex in a different way, and that actually casual sex is so usually portrayed as some kind of catastrophe, particularly for middle-aged women. And I just thought this is untrue. And actually women can enjoy casual sex and it needn't have massive emotional ramifications for them. That the author feel any desire at all to punish her by letting something terrible happen to her. And I really just wanted to explore this whole other side of female sexuality, which is, you know, very rarely allowed to rear its head, which is kind of seen as too male, as the kind of, you know, shag them and then leave them, or just, you know, and she wants to have the sex, she enjoys the sex that she has, but she also wants them to go so she can just have a bath or go to bed or have a cigarette or have a glass of wine, or, you know, or so she's not looking for someone. This is not the point of the book, which I suppose, again, was in some ways related to A Girl as a Half-Worn Thing, which, again, was a book that wasn't about a female character looking for someone to love them or save them, but, you know, using sex in a very different way for different things. And I suppose I'm kind of just very tired of this, of kind of sex as catastrophe for women. And, you know, I think we don't have to bow to those stereotypes. And so why should we?
Yes. And thank you for breaking that up a bit, because it is refreshing. Compared to your first two books, readers have felt like this one is more removed, less intense. Her emotions have cooled, one reviewer said. I wasn't sure if they were talking about you or your protagonist, frankly. So I asked the question, is this
well,
true?
Well, I'm a female writer, so they probably mean both, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's another question we can get to. This thing that people do of always wondering whether your fiction must be true. But you are bringing a less intense and raw emotion to Strange Hotel, it seems, over your first two books. So does this speak to a kind of evolution for you in your own writing, or is this just a singular effort that shouldn't indicate anything about future books?
Yeah, I don't think this is a sign of this is the way it's going to be. I wanted to do something different. I felt, you know, Girl as a Half-Worn Thing is a very particular type of book. Lesser Bohemians was in some ways similar, but moved on. And it just felt right to try something different. And I was keen to think about having used language in the past as a way to kind of pin the character to the wall and to allow the reader to live through those characters, to not be able to escape them, to be intensely kind of emotionally involved and almost as though what's happening was happening inside the reader themselves. I thought, well, it would be interesting to think about how language works differently in middle age, and that, you know, because of course, when you're young, you are willing the world to happen to you. You are waiting for experience and you have so little of it that you open yourself to it and it comes rushing in and it does great things to you and it does terrible things to you. Mm-hmm. But when you get older, the world cannot get in quite so easily. You know where the dangers lie. You know where you need to be careful. You know where you want to protect yourself. You know what you're willing to go through and what you just feel you haven't got the energy for anymore. And how does that, how could that be reflected in language? And that obviously meant that language had to be used in a very different way to the first two books. And I suppose that then accounts for the much greater formality of the language and absolutely the lack of kind of rampant emotion everywhere, is that she's not that person and she has no desire to be that person who is having great emotional experiences. And so the language became much more formal, and the language became about distance, about trying to, how do you keep people at bay with words? How do you, you know, the more polite you are, the more formal you are, the further distance you put between yourself and another person, the more, you know, you don't just say thanks, you say thank you very much indeed, that's very kind of you. It's your most polite way to say it. But that's also a way of keeping people far, of not putting yourself on the same level as them, and of, you know, of just keeping that safe place. And so it's, as with the other books, the way that it is written is, you know, the style is dictated by the content, is dictated by the style in a way. It's not, I don't feel like this is how I'm now going to write books from now on. This is how this book had to be written. And I think it's, it felt like a worthwhile experiment. And I don't know what will be next. So,
which is perfect. I hope that you have something very freeing and, you know, lots of possibility for whatever comes. You are not afraid to take on the establishment, which I really appreciate. You're not afraid to take on people's judgments or accusations either. So at a public reading, a man challenged you and asked you if you found it easy to objectify men, to which you said yes. and he seemed displeased. He wanted a different answer, clearly. But you said, you know, yes, I already answered your question. And then this is just going to give another example of how you take on these kinds of pushbacks. In another interview, you said, I think there's a lot of angry old men in publishing and in the media who really object to having to take this foolish female business seriously. And they don't really hide it. And they don't have to. And that's a problem. So it seems like you're countering this problem by speaking up and speaking out on behalf of yourself, of course, but I see that as on behalf of women and women writers specifically. How important is it to you to push back and speak up in order to affect change for women writers? Or is that, you know, even part of your orientation to it?
Well, I mean, I think it's difficult because in some ways I don't feel as though I push back for women writers or because I'm a woman writer. I push back because I object to art being strangled by idiocy, which happens all the time. And it just so happens that a lot of the idiocy comes from these kind of dumb, settled old guys. And they ride out to attack women particularly. Mm. So it's out of necessity rather than, you know, an ideological desire to do battle with the male establishment. And because, you know, really, I think art comes first. And if you're using my sex as a means to ignore what I'm saying, as a way to diminish what I am trying to achieve, the end that I'm trying to get to, then that's something that I don't want to, you know, get into a row about it, but I will if I have to. And it's so tiresome. I mean, you know, I think the wonderful Anne Enright said recently, you know, how completely infuriating it is that women have to spend so much time fixing a problem which they didn't create.
Right.
But, you know, and I feel that, and I feel like, you know, I'm asked these questions all the time and I have to answer them all the time. And I'd much rather be talking about art and literature, but, you know, where we are in this time, in this point in history, these are the questions that have got to be answered. And I don't see why I shouldn't be forthright because they will attack whether I'm forthright or not forthright. So I might as well, you know, say what's on my mind.
Emer, thank you. You're a delight. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in today to hear from Emer McBride. I was so moved by the part of the interview in which she talks about how much of the world we let in when we're young versus how much we keep out as we get older. We open ourselves to the world when we're young and things happen to us, wonderful things and bad things. As we get older, we control what we allow in because of our experiences. How Emer attempted to sort this out through language and that she did so is an amazing feat. She calls it an experiment, and I would say it's a very successful one. The interview gives us a lot to think about, and this is the gift of Women Lit events in general. Please visit www.womenlit.org and the Bay Area Book Festival's Unbound series for upcoming events. We're still going. So as we said at the beginning of the show, today was episode 100. We're celebrating this milestone and know that we couldn't have done it without our listeners. So thank you. Thank you for tuning in, for spreading the word. If you want to give Grant a gift, I'd like to suggest a rating or a review. It's a gesture in support of our show and supports us to get sponsors and find new listeners. So thank you on his behalf if you can make the time. And we'll be back for show 101 next week. Thanks, y'all.